Some folks in St. Louis are dusting off an old proposal for education in Missouri. A recent editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch suggests it might be time to revisit a recommendation from the late 1960s to unify the school districts of the two major metropolitan areas in the state. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll learn more about what's called the Spainhower solution. But first, we recently celebrated the anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, a Kansas case that went to the Supreme Court, ultimately desegregating schools. We'll share some little-known stories from the months and years that followed. Stay tuned for Central Standard. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to look at some of the historical controversies surrounding education in both Kansas and Missouri, perhaps shedding some light on the debates that circle around this issue today. In the first half of our show, we'll be revisiting Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court case that started in Topeka, Kansas. This spring marked the 60th anniversary of that decision, which ruled separate but equal. Inherently unequal. Today, we time travel back to Kansas in the months and years that followed that decision. With me for that discussion is Justin Sochacki. He's an interpretive park ranger in Kansas. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me on.
So just quickly, what does an interpretive park ranger do?
Well, we have 401 national parks across the country, and we need to have someone tell our visitors why the place they're visiting is important and why that story is preserved as part of our national heritage.
So you do this sort of the communication with people about the history of this important place.
Exactly. It would be working with school groups, working with regular visitors off the street, or when we're lucky, we get to travel to NPR stations and talk about the case.
Not exactly what people imagine park rangers doing.
No, but the sky is limitless if you want to work for the Park Service, so check out our website.
Could you give our listeners a brief refresher on Brown v. Board of Education?
Sure. Brown v. Board of Education was a decision the Supreme Court made in 1954 that effectively said separating children by their race into separate schools violated the Constitution, specifically the 14th Amendment that said citizens of states are entitled to the equal protection of the law. So that case ruled that racial segregation in education violated the Constitution.
What was the aftermath of that decision like in Kansas? What are some of the things that happened or maybe didn't happen as a result of Brown v. Board here on the ground?
I think it's important to take one step back and ask the question is, what was Brown intended to do? Yes, it was
Good
intended
question.
To separate, or excuse me, to integrate schools, but more importantly, to end segregation in bus stops, in hospitals, in restaurants, in hotels. And that's the broader strategy of Brown, was to end the laws that allowed states to create those separate facilities. And in that, Brown was tremendously successful because states can no longer create those laws. If you look more narrowly at, are schools integrated and do we have a blend of diverse students in every classroom that reflects the diversity of a community, it depends on where you look. And so in Kansas, another little-known fact is that the Topeka Board of Education actually began the desegregation process the year before the Supreme Court handed down its ruling. Basically, they knew which way the wind was going to blow and that segregation was about to end. So very quietly, without notifying the state of Kansas, the Topeka Board of Education decided to end segregation and begin integrating their schools.
How do we know about this? I mean, I would guess that they're doing something before the rule of law has given them the go-ahead. Did they document that well, or did they kind of try to cover their tracks on that?
No, it wasn't a secret. It wasn't a conspiracy. You can read about it in the board minutes of the Topeka Board of Education for anyone who goes to care and dig through them. So no, it wasn't a conspiracy. It was more a matter of they knew that they were going to lose, and so they better go ahead and start that process. And another aspect of that is, even though you desegregate schools and say, we're not going to separate children into discreetly white schools and black schools, if the neighborhoods are still segregated, which they by and large are, it doesn't immediately mean you have blended schools. It means you have a couple of black students who lived in an integrated neighborhood, and they become the first children that go into what were previously all white schools.
How did that play out in Topeka, where the case started?
it played out very slowly, and Tom can probably give you a few more specifics, our historian. It was really only a handful of children in the several years following the decision, or in Topeka's case, the year before the decision, that you started to see a couple of black children attend what were previously all white schools.
We'll be talking to Tom in just a second, who you referred to, Tom Rosenblum. But first, I'd like to ask you, how did this compare with things happening in other places outside of Kansas City at around this time? I'm thinking of Virginia.
Yes, and that is a very different story. If Topeka is one end of the spectrum of the school board takes the initiative to end it before they have to, in the wake of the Brown decision in 1954, the Supreme Court didn't provide any guidance as to, okay, how are you going to desegregate your schools? Because they knew, especially in states in the Deep South, that there was going to be dramatic opposition to the decision. So it wasn't until a year later in 1955 the court passed what was known as Brown 2, and that basically said these cases are going to be remanded or given back to the district courts where they were filed, and those judges are going to be responsible for overseeing the desegregation plans in their districts. And the same time you have that process happening, you have almost every Southern congressman sign what's called the Southern Manifesto, which said we're going to resist this decision with everything that we have. And so in the case of Virginia, a few years after the decision in Prince Edward County, the Board of Supervisors basically said, we're not going to appropriate any funds for public education. And they effectively closed the schools in that county for 5 years. And what they did is sort of unheard of by today's standard. They took money in lieu of tax payments to the state. The county basically gave donations, and that allowed them to open what were called segregation academies, which were basically private schools.
Wow.
That then affluent white students could go to using this donation money. And so who lost out were, of course, African-American students and also poor white students. And so some children in that county in Prince Edward lost 5 years of educational opportunity. Some went to live with relatives in completely different places like Baltimore just so they could do what everyone takes as a basic right now is go to elementary school.
Well, you know, you've laid out sort of two dramatic ends of a spectrum in terms of how specific places respond to the mandate to desegregate. What was the pace of desegregation nationally? Let's look at, say, the 10-year mark. 10 years after Brown v. Board, what was the picture?
There was a study done by the Harvard Desegregation Project, and they basically looked at the rate and found that 10 years after the decision, so in 1964, effectively 1 out of 50 African-American children in the South were attending an integrated school. So that's roughly 2% of the children in the Deep South were attending an integrated school 10 years later.
Well, I'd like to now invite Tom Rosenblum, a Parks historian, to join us by phone. Hi, Tom. Thanks for speaking with us this morning.
How are you all?
Great. Tom, you've pored over the archives documenting this time period in Kansas. What jumps out to you as something that people should know about the experiences of ordinary people at this time that maybe we don't tend to hear much about?
Well, I'm the one who actually goes through all the school board minute books and all of that. And as Justin said, Topeka in September of 1953, and it was a spur of the moment. I think it was about 12:30 in the morning on September 4th. All of a sudden, someone put out a motion that we desegregate the schools, and it passed. There apparently wasn't even much discussion. They came up with a 3-year plan, which most places is a gradual plan. But the one thing that I think, and it just happens to be something we are working on right now, is one of the groups impacted negatively were African American teachers. The estimates are as many as 40 to 45% lost their positions.
Can you explain that?
10 years after Brown.
Unpack that a little bit for us.
Okay. When the case is heard, it is about students, justice, equality of opportunity for African American students. This does not immediately translate into fair play for black teachers. There was a general belief that white parents would not tolerate an African-American man or woman standing up in front of their children. So in Topeka, whereas you start integrating students in 1953, it is not until the 1957-58 school year that African-American teachers start moving in. And it was only, I believe, two and they are assigned to teach half day at four different schools.
So are you saying that this is at previously white schools?
Yes. And a matter of fact, there's a lot of evidence that the superintendent of schools very carefully picked the schools in the sense that the principal that was here over at Monroe, J.B. Holland, was sent to what was then known as Southwest Elementary School. Today it's Whitson. He picked that school intentionally because there tended to be a larger group of parents who were professionals, lawyers, doctors in that neighborhood, and they believed these people would be possibly more accepting of change than others.
You know, you gave us a statistic that's a pretty harrowing statistic, that 40 to 45% of African-American yeah. teachers lost their jobs. Is that number specific to Topeka, or is that
a
national
number?
No,
that would be nationwide. Topeka itself, although history was not on, I see Topeka's teachers, black teachers, probably did not see history as being on their side, because in 1941, Topeka desegregated the junior high schools in the sense that in Topeka there was a system where black children attended elementary school till eighth grade, entered junior high in the ninth, and then went on to high school. White children, of course, moved on to junior high in the seventh grade. And that went to court, and the school board lost. Immediately after that, six African-American teachers were fired, and two others had their hours reduced to part-time. So experience had shown black teachers that their jobs hung in the balance.
Well, what did happen to those teachers who found themselves suddenly without work? Was there anyone available to defend them or help them? Was there any such movement?
Actually, nobody. The school board expressed regret was about all that happened. And you have to remember that many of these there were marriage bars at the time. So your average teacher is college-educated, young, unmarried woman. There's very little left open to them
yeah.
in terms of professions.
How?
And so they are losing, their livelihood, but also there's very little else. Many teachers I know, just before the Brown case, as it was being argued, actually just quit and went elsewhere looking for work.
How was the
even though there was no, you know, they had not yet been fired. We started, I think we had 27 black teachers in Topeka, maybe 1950, and in 54 or 55 was down to 21 or 22.
Well, how was the quality of education children received affected by this scenario? Did black students learning from white teachers have a different qualitative experience in school in those early years of integration?
It does not appear that there was. One of the things, and I know that the NAACP in New York seemed oblivious to this, one of the reasons Topeka teachers could be staunch defenders of a dual school system was simply the quality of the schools. That the black schools, the NAACP themselves admitted, in many cases the black schools are actually better than the white schools. I believe there were more black teachers with master's degrees than white teachers and so on and so forth. So it wasn't anything that the kids in the black schools were getting, you know, deprived of anything. We had the same curricula, same facilities. Again, teacher loads were the same, everything. Topeka embraced separate but equal before the Supreme Court ever thought of it.
Well, let's hold that thought, because I'm going to remind our listeners that you're hearing Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education, particularly in the early years following that ruling. And I'm here with two gentlemen from the Parks Department, Tom Rosenblum with us by phone. He's a historian, and Justin Sochacki, who is an interpretive park ranger. And Justin, do you want to chime in on this?
Yes, just to share an anecdote of a visitor who came into the park several years ago when I was working there, and he attended elementary school in Topeka at the time of desegregation, an African-American man. And he was one of the earliest students to move to a white school, and he described what it was like to go partway through his elementary education at a school where he knew everyone, his parents knew his teacher. They walked to school, you know, they came to school together, and then to be one of the only black faces in a room full of white students where you're not quite sure what they think about you being there, and a teacher that your parents don't necessarily know, and just how unsafe he felt because it was such an uncertain environment. And that's a story that is not common in the story of Brown, because the schools were excellent in Topeka. And that was a great loss to the community when those teachers lost their jobs and when that community center started to evaporate somewhat.
There's something I'd like to ask both of you, and I'll point this toward you first, and then I'd like to hear what Tom has to say. Are the problems with the case itself or its implementation? Because most people today clearly believe very strongly that segregated schools belong in the past, that doesn't have a place in our present worldview. But at the same time, some of these issues could have lasting legacies today that aren't positive, that aren't unanimously wonderful.
One thing the lawyers of Brown knew very well is that they could file a case and hope for an outcome, but they would never know the exact wording of the holdings of the court. They would never know exactly where litigation was going to take them. So if you look at Brown and the legacies of Brown, we've eliminated the laws that expressly prohibit separating African-American students based on race. But to try to come up with solutions to segregation in housing, to segregation, economic segregation that's been going on for centuries, those are not easy questions or not easy answers to find. And so we're still struggling with, we've eliminated those laws that expressly prohibit that separation, but it doesn't mean that our society reflects what the vision of those lawyers and parents and students were in creating a student body that reflected the community.
And when you talk about segregation in terms of housing, when the school district boundaries are drawn around neighborhoods, then that it, I mean.
Well, here's a good example. A few years before Brown, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Shelley v. Kramer in 1948, which basically said you can't put a restrictive covenant on a real estate sale. And it was actually in St. Louis, Missouri. A family bought a house and they were sued by a family in the neighborhood because the covenant governing that real estate said you can't sell this to anyone of African descent. And so when that case went to the Supreme Court, the court struck that down and said you can't prohibit the sale of a home with a restrictive covenant. Three justices had to recuse themselves in part because they had real estate dealings that had something to do with restrictive covenants. That's how pervasive that type of instrument was to precisely prevent African Americans from moving into certain neighborhoods.
Tom Rosenblum, what do you think about all of this? I mean, how would you capture some of the complexity of the legacy of Brown v. Board today, even?
Well, again, one of the interesting things about, particularly Justin mentioned Brown too, is when the court came up with the now famous "with all deliberate speed," the judgment of integration was not based on how much you had done, but how much you intended to do. And this, of course, opened the door for decades. I mean, you have federal courts literally running school districts in America for up to 20 years at some point. But Brown, again, I think the key to Brown is, again, its immediate impact is just so complex. It's going to, you know, here in Topeka, where full integration meant placing two or three black kids in with a class with 30 whites, it's not really, you know, I think they called it a minor administrative adjustment. In South Carolina, in Clarendon County, South Carolina, 90% of that classroom is going to be African American.
Wow.
And so the obstacles local school boards were going to face, even if they wanted to do this, were just monumental. And I think we're still going through that. Today, we tend to, I've heard the phrase, I'm the son of the attorneys who argued the Brown case. He speaks quite frequently, and what he will tell you is he believes schools today are more segregated than they were in 1950.
Well, that does lead us to the fact that in the next half of the show, we'll be talking about a 1968 proposal from a Missouri state representative urging Kansas City and St. Louis to create unified school districts for their greater metropolitan areas. But some people say now that we need to dust off that idea. First, I'd like to bring in the guest for that discussion to weigh in on the aftermath of Brown v. Board in Missouri, a historically southern state. Please welcome to the conversation University of Kansas Professor of Education John Rury. Hi, John.
Hi.
So, first, you're writing a book on the history of education in Missouri. That is a bold undertaking for a University of Kansas professor.
Well, it's metropolitan Kansas City, so it involves both the Kansas side and the Missouri side.
Well, you've been listening to this conversation about Kansas. How did this all play out in Missouri with its history as technically a southern state?
Well, Kansas City desegregated pretty quickly after Brown and fairly uneventfully. at least for a while. And
that's on both sides of the state line?
Well, the action was on the Missouri side. Actually, there had been a case in Johnson County years before Brown concerning segregation of a elementary school in what became the Shawnee Mission School District. And that was settled in the Kansas Supreme Court in the favor of the litigants. So basically, that issue had been more or less resolved on the Kansas side, although you did have a segregated high school in Kansas City, Kansas, Sumner High School, until the 70s. But most of the desegregation issue was on the Missouri side in the Kansas City, Missouri School District.
And what did you see there?
Well, it happened pretty smoothly. Kansas City had taken steps to desegregate parks and swimming pools and so on before Brown. And the district was pretty proactive in responding to Brown pretty quickly had a plan ready to go by the time the 55 Brown 2 decision came down.
You mentioned Sumner. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of that school and how it is that it remained essentially segregated until the 70s?
Well, it was started in the 1920s, and it sort of grew out of a dispute between and the death of a teenager in the 20s, and resulting in legislation in the Kansas legislature that permitted segregation in cities of a certain size. And that was also, you know, part of the Topeka story. Sumner becomes this sort of premier African-American high school that was especially well known for its excellent teachers. And it's sort of the same phenomenon that Tom was talking about a minute ago. You know, the African-American people with highly educated African-Americans didn't have many other career options, so most of them went into teaching. So you had some excellent teachers, and the students responded very well. Sumner was especially good in science. They won lots and lots of science fair competitions in greater Kansas City.
I'll ask you the same question I asked our other guests. You know, we typically today look back on segregation as an unfavorable state of affairs, and we feel very fond of Brown v. Board of Education and the legacy, at least the philosophical legacy of that case. And it sounds like it's more complicated than that. How do we reconcile this sort
of
complex?
Yeah, I think I know. I've also wrote a book a couple of years ago with a colleague here at KU, Shirley Hill. It looks at African-American secondary schools. And sure, there were outstanding examples like Sumner and a few others, particularly in the, sort of the border states. But the vast majority of African-American schools, of course, were in the South, and they were really grotesquely under-resourced. Even though the teachers had similar qualifications, the students did not have the same facilities. The libraries were always smaller. The books were out of date. The lab facilities were borrowed from other, you know, the leftover stuff that other schools had discarded. And even after the southern states invested great sums of money to equalize things, it still never reached equality.
Well, we're going to come back from the break and talk about what still needs to be done to desegregate our schools and an old proposal that some think might be the answer. But it's time for me to say goodbye to Justin Sochacki and Tom Rosenblum from Kansas Parks. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you both about the legacy of Brown v. Board. We'll be right back to talk about a controversial proposal to consolidate Kansas City, Missouri, and St. Louis school districts. That's coming up right after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Right now, there are 15 school districts either in or overlapping with Kansas City, Missouri. But in the 1960s, a state representative in Missouri by the name of Spainhower suggested that that number should be one. Here to talk about that is John Rury, a University of Kansas professor who we've been speaking with already on the show. Hi again, John.
Hi.
So what is the Spainhower Report? Tell us the story of how this Spainhower character came to lead a commission for reforming public education in Missouri back in 1966.
Well, James Spainhower was at the time a representative in the Missouri legislature, and he was a Democrat and a liberal, and he had been a minister, and he had a PhD from MU and in political science. He was interested in reform, making things, you know, improving education in particular. Now, from what I understand, it was actually Tom Eagleton, who was lieutenant governor at the time, who came up with this idea that education could be both more efficiently organized and more equitably organized if it wasn't divided into so many tiny school districts.
Explain that.
Historically, American school governance has been organized around, at the beginning, individual schools. This was the idea of the common school in the 19th century and early 20th century, is that the schools were organized by the local communities, and every child had to be able to walk to the school. So basically, you had a school and a school district for every 50 to 100 families, and maybe a 5-mile square area.
That's interesting that it goes back to the idea of kids needing to be able to walk to school. That's kind of gaining traction again.
Oh, absolutely. Neighborhood schools is a very important concept to this day. So one of the problems, of course, as things change and you get more efficient and larger, particularly in the cities, you get larger school systems developing in the late 1800s and early 20th century, whereas the countryside is still organized in all these very small schools, which are then seen to be backwards. They don't have the technology. They don't have the curriculum. They still have just one or two teachers, so they're not allowing for specialization. And then you have to worry about high schools and so on. So in the 20th century, there's a big push towards what's called school consolidation.
I was interested in this Missouri School Reorganization Commission called by the governor.
You know, I'm leading up to that. So the idea of consolidating districts had its historical roots in this process of combining lots of smaller districts to create bigger ones. And so Eagleton is just taking that a step further in the mid-60s, saying, well, why don't we create really big districts that will allow for a lot of efficiency and equality across all these different types of communities? And I'm pretty sure when he started off, he was not thinking about cities and suburbs. He was thinking about the whole state.
Okay, so explain the group that he convenes and that Jay Spainhower is at the head of it. What is their mission?
Well, Spainhower takes the reins on this proposal, and he gets the legislature, his colleagues, and this shows you how, you know, again, in 1966, this is still very, very early in all of the eventual controversy over desegregation and race. So in 1966, the Missouri legislature says, okay, this is an interesting idea. They appropriate, I think it's, you know, on the order of $50,000, which in today's money is probably several hundred thousand, to conduct a study, a feasibility study of this and create a commission to look into it. And that's what Spainhower does. So it's important to recognize that at the beginning, this is not considered to be a particularly controversial idea.
What is it that ends up being controversial about the ultimate recommendation of this group?
Okay, so there's sort of two dimensions to this. And I'll quote Dr. Spainhower, since I did have a chance to speak to him about this a little bit.
Because he's still alive.
He's still around, yes. And still, you know, very sort of interested in these issues. One is that he said nobody wanted to give up their basketball team. So communities rally around their schools, particularly the high schools, and for many smaller communities in the countryside, this is an important point of identity for the local community. So there's a lot of resistance on that count. And then what the commission ran into really hadn't been anticipated in the metropolitan areas was the question of race. and perceptions about urban versus suburban schools.
In a report that you wrote about this with a colleague, you quote from several letters that suburban families wrote in sort of angry response to this recommendation. And a lot of them were surprising in how just overtly either, frankly, classist or racist they were.
Right. Vitriolic is one way to describe it. And that was surprising to the commission members to hear that response. Again, I think, you know, on our side, you know, at this point in history, on our side of that historical divide, it's not so surprising because of the busing controversies and the desegregation controversies that occurred later. But again, remember, this is 1967 and 68 when this is happening. At that time, the Kansas City public schools are still considered to be, in many people's eyes, good schools. Southwest High was widely considered to be the best school in the state of Missouri. There was lots of other. Van Horn was considered to be a very good school. Central High School had only recently become all African American. And Paseo was in the process of transition. Southeast High was still predominantly white and considered to be kind of a sort of a blue collar but a good school. So
Are the problems that the Spainhauer Commission is trying to solve not the problems of his own time, but problems that they maybe foresaw?
Well, I think some people, particularly the consultants that the commission hired who were academics coming in, they recognized pretty quickly the sort of racial and desegregation implications of this plan.
Let's back up, actually, and make sure that everyone understands what the plan calls for. If it had been implemented, there would be 20 school districts in Missouri. And right now, I believe there are 520. Is that right?
Something like that, yes.
So that's a difference of 500. What would be different about a 20-district state?
You'd have larger administrative units that would be overseeing schools in bigger areas. Now, the Spainhauer plan called for local committees to still oversee local schools, but they would be serviced by these larger administrative entities that would equalize the taxation and the costs, and you'd gain some efficiencies from scale, right? Buying things in larger numbers and textbooks and that sort of thing. So there would be cost savings and at the same time less variation in resources across districts. So
right.
That's the sort of equality piece.
And Kansas City, Missouri would have one school district, which would include within its boundaries the nearest suburbs in the vicinity. Is that right?
Yes.
So how would that be different? I mean, it would be on an objective level very different, but what would be some of the implications?
Well, there would be you know, greater equity of resources. As time went on, and this was, again, not so evident in 1968, but by the early 70s, the Kansas City School District was struggling to pay its bills, basically, as its tax base was eroding.
Why was the tax base eroding?
Because middle-class whites were leaving the district and businesses were leaving as the suburbs were growing.
Yeah.
So that's the basic dynamic.
And these are these suburban communities that are forming in some ways as part of white flight are the same communities responding with these vitriolic letters you're describing.
Individuals in those districts are responding that way, yes. And all of this, I should say, is on the Missouri side. The picture is a little more it's complicated by the fact that there's a state line involved. And of course, at this time, Johnson County on the Kansas side is booming, and so many businesses and people who are moving into the metropolitan area at that time, who in previous decades might have considered going to Kansas City, are now going to Johnson County. So that's taking potential resources away also.
Well, that is interesting because under the Spain-Hauer recommendation, there wouldn't be a neighboring Missouri suburb that you could flee to not participate in the Kansas City, Missouri school district, but you could still flee to Kansas.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And I suppose that there would be Missouri communities that would be outside of the district that eventually could grow as a consequence of that.
So let's get back to those responses to Spain-Hauer's recommendation. What were some of the responses, not just from these letters that you're describing, but from other politicians, from various parts of the community?
Well, they just—I mean, they were sort of low-key in their response. They did. They tried not to make a big issue out of it, because it's a very it was sort of it was a delicate issue because it concerned race, and it's coming so early in the sort of the controversies about desegregation. It's well before busing starts, so that's not even an issue on the national landscape at the time. So when they were asked about it, they would just say, well, it's crazy. It's a crazy plan. It makes no sense. And particularly the superintendents who were often asked about it, like Doolin, who was superintendent in North Kansas City, or James Hazlett in Kansas City, they were very cautious. But the suburban superintendents would say that they thought it was just kind of a ridiculous idea, whereas Hazlett, interestingly, in Kansas City, he said it was interesting and that it was worth exploration. So the urban superintendents around the state tended to have a more positive view of it than the suburban superintendents.
That's interesting because it sounds like the governor essentially understood this, believed this to be the best solution, and got this commission going to confirm something they already thought was true. And yet, so then it's surprising that it didn't gain more traction.
Well, they were sort of blindsided by this whole question of suburban versus urban, which, of course, is linked to race. So that was surprising. And immediately at the state government level, the politicians just backed off up from it. And when eventually the commission put together a recommendation, Spain-Hauer couldn't find any other legislator in the state to co-sponsor a bill. Nobody wanted to be a part of it.
What were the differences between the responses of suburbanites in Kansas City and those of suburbanites in St. Louis? Because the recommendation was the same for both cities.
Yeah. Spain-Hauer commented, and we found this in looking at the letters also, is that the response was a lot more negative in Kansas City than it was in St. Louis. And there's sort of a couple of reasons, I think, that play into this. Number one, the St. Louis suburban districts had already dealt somewhat with the question of desegregation, and you had a couple of suburban districts that were undergoing integration at that time. And St. Louis also had a group of leaders that sort of spanned the metropolitan area, and they had some organizations. They had this White House Conference Committee that had been formed in the 50s that included both suburban leaders and city leaders. So they were able to take a more detached and comprehensive view of things. And that just didn't happen in Kansas City.
In St. Louis—
I think part of it, I think the fact that you have Johnson County— and so many of the metro leaders in the Kansas City metro area were starting to live on the Kansas side of the border, complicated things.
And St. Louis adopted what was called a transfer plan for urban students. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it came out of the desegregation lawsuit there, and the suburban districts agreed to it under some pressure.
What was it?
Well, it was a fraction, a relatively small fraction. I'm trying to think of what it was, something on the order of 10% or 15% of students from St. Louis were bused out to the suburbs, and it lasted quite a long time. It only recently has sort of kind of wound down. Now, one theory about this is that the St. Louis districts felt a lot more vulnerable in the lawsuit than the Kansas City districts, because the St. Louis districts had this experience of some integration, and so from a legal standpoint, they were more vulnerable to arguments that they had contributed to the process of segregation in the metropolitan area. So I think that's maybe one reason why they were a little more amenable to a cross-district busing plan, as limited as it was. Whereas in Kansas City, when those ideas were floated, back in the late 70s, when the Jenkins case was first beginning to form, the Kansas City suburbs expressed no interest whatsoever in participating in any kind of a plan like that.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, and here by ISDN from the offices of Kansas Public Radio is John Rury talking about a recommendation from 1968 to unify the Kansas City, Missouri school district. The idea sounds radical to many people, even today, but with still troubled urban school districts surrounded by strong districts in their immediate vicinity, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch recommends dusting off that old proposal. Listeners, what do you think? Would it work for Kansas City? Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. But for now, let's listen to Governor Jay Nixon speaking about the importance of education in Missouri in his State of the State address delivered this past January.
Our single greatest responsibility as elected officials, as parents, as citizens of our state is to make sure that every child in Missouri has an opportunity to achieve his or her dreams. And we all know that opportunity starts with education.
So, John Rury, when you hear that, what do you hear? I mean, it's been almost a half century since the Spainhauer recommendation. How would you characterize educational opportunity for all Missouri kids then versus now?
Well, I'll tell you, here's what it comes down to in very basic terms, if we pay attention to the research on achievement. The primary driver of achievement is the child's family background, and particularly the education of his or her parents. The second most important factor are the other students that the student is in school with. So that's where the whole question of integration, either by social class or by race or whatever dimension you want to consider, comes into play. The third, which is also important, is the teachers. So that's the big impact of integration, is putting kids from different backgrounds together where they can learn from each other. And the kids who have fewer family background resources can benefit from kids who have more.
Do you think that's a scenario we have today?
Well, no, we're having greater segregation according to social class now, and that's the most worrisome trend, I think, that's going on. And so you look at Kansas City, Missouri School District today, it's highly concentrated numbers of kids from poverty backgrounds or low income backgrounds, and that's true of most big cities around the country. It's more true today than it was in the past.
Your paper, published with Donna Gardner of William Jewell College in July of 2013, makes a fairly early reference to a 2012 ruling that three of the five suburban districts surrounding the Kansas City, Missouri school district did not have to participate in a state-mandated transfer program after the Kansas City, Missouri district lost accreditation. What are the implications of that? And can you maybe explain that to us?
Well, you know, here's the thing about the voluntary transfer program, I personally think it's an idea worth exploring, and the positive aspect of it is kids from these concentrated areas of low income having the opportunity to go to schools in areas where there's more affluence, and that's an enormous opportunity for those children. And we've seen this work in other parts of the country. Very positively. So,
what was the reason why it didn't gain acceptance here and didn't go through?
Well, you know, I think there's resistance on both ends. There's a lot of history with the Kansas City, Missouri school district, like there is with any school district. And Mayor James has sort of made statements of, well, you know, the educators in Kansas City know how to deal with the urban kids better, and there's nothing special about black and white kids learning together. And I think a lot of that's true. On the other hand, there is a lot to be gained for kids from lower income backgrounds to be attending with more affluent kids. There's things to be gained on both sides.
That's what I was going to ask. Do you think that the affluent kids have something to gain by having exposure to people from backgrounds other than their own?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of research pointing to those benefits also.
Do you hear echoes of the Spainhower Commission when you hear stories like this? Because essentially saying that school kids from the Kansas City, Missouri school district should be able to have shared resources with kids in these neighboring districts is kind of revisiting this idea of consolidation.
Absolutely. And you know, the idea of integration, social integration, was never, at least at the outset, not the objective of Spainhower, but the Spainhower idea opens the door to that, most definitely.
There's a quote in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch article that sort of encourages people in St. Louis to take another look at this idea. It's a quote from the Spainhower Commission that it gives me chills. It says, "We accept a trip to the moon as inevitable within the next few years, but we resist joining with our neighbors in the next village to develop school facilities that will enable our children to develop their minds and bodies so that they, in the next half century, may make our accomplishments to date only stepping stones to the future they will build." And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch's response to that is, "Nearly a half century of resistance and several trips to the moon and back have passed since those words were written." How does that strike you?
I think it's absolutely true. And it's really remarkable how we have failed to move forward on that front, and despite of all of the goodwill and efforts that have been made in that regard, we've just fallen short.
Do you have any criticism of Spainhower's proposal? Do you think that there's anything about, I mean, we've been speaking about it in this way that encourages people to take another look, but does it have flaws that you can point to that you would not want people to revisit?
Well, Spainhower was naive. You know, he didn't really realize the tiger he had grabbed by the tail. Now, you know, if he had approached it a little differently and in a more measured way and had reached out and tried to establish some relationships with key players, particularly in the metropolitan areas, particularly in Kansas City, he may have had a better chance of success, although it would have been an uphill battle.
Let's hear from Gary in Kansas City, Missouri.
Good
Hi,
morning.
Gary.
Good morning. My question is, I moved here in 1979 as a young adult, and, you know, they were talking about how difficult the schools were at that time. For the last 30 years, anyway, we've been talking about should the state of Missouri take over the Kansas City, Missouri schools. And I really would like to know the opinion of what would that mean, and does your guest recommend the state taking it over? Because obviously it's been a failure for decades and generations of students here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Gary. I'll go ahead and let our guest respond to that. First of all, he characterizes this as a failure. Is that a statement that you agree with from the outset?
Well, you can't really. I mean, the district has had its problems. There's no doubt about that. Most districts do have issues. Urban districts tend to have more. The state taking over the district is not a solution. That's happened in lots of other states. Compton, California is sort of the poster child for this. The state's taken it over several times. The state doesn't know how to run a school district any better than the local educators do in most cases. So the result is usually not any better than it was before. Like I said, the primary factors that are determining the outcomes in the Kansas City schools is not the educators as much as it is the backgrounds of the kids who are there and their needs being really quite different than the kids on the other side of those district lines.
The lines are kind of weird. Can we talk about that for a second? Because I actually really had to do quite a bit of legwork to get a drawing of the boundaries and a specific list. And it looks like there are 15 districts that are either in or overlapping with Kansas City, Missouri. And some of them have these weird little situations like Belton, the part of the Belton district that overlaps with Kansas City, Missouri. There's also a zoning regulation that you can't have housing there. So it's there are kind of these weird anomalies. Can you talk about how those lines were drawn?
Well, a lot of it starts with the annexation process that by which Kansas City grew in the 50s and early 60s. Cookingham, who was the sort of treasurer, I think it was his official position in Kansas City in the 50s, had this fear that Kansas City would become locked in like St. Louis by the growth of suburbs around it. So while there was still a lot of unincorporated land, the Kansas City undertook annexation. And the annexation rules at that time were very favorable to cities like Kansas City. So it that's why it expanded north of the river and to the south pretty rapidly. But when this happened, the decision was made not to incorporate those school districts. School districts, of course, are separate entities from other municipal governments or townships. So the decision was made not to attempt to consolidate those districts into Kansas City in the 50s, way before desegregation was an issue. Now, some will argue that this, of course, was an issue lurking in the background. But the Kansas City Star at the time editorialized that it was the financial and bond indebtedness and those kinds of issues that would make it a real mess or problematic to do that. So the decision was made in the latter 50s not to attempt to consolidate those districts. And of course, it eventually has results in the situation you're talking about now.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's conversation. I'd like to thank all of today's guests, including John Rury at the University of Kansas, for joining us today. And John has been with us thanks to Kansas Public Radio, who has graciously teleported him here through the magic of radio. Thank you so much to KPR. To listen back to today's show, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also enjoy past shows while you're there. Tomorrow, tune in for a conversation about the civil rights movement right here in Kansas City with a leader of that movement, Fuzzy Thompson Nelson. He'll join us in the studio for that discussion, so don't miss it. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.